Welcome to the Technori Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Catoon. Joining us on today's show, Edward Woodford. He is the CEO of Seed CX. He's co-founder. I'm interested in this because I'm very interested in like the changing winds of crypto, the real players and the real investments versus the bullshit ones. I take pride in my ability to read market knowledge and make investments. I think sometimes shrewd investments. I'm outperforming the market by 40% right now on all of my little investor market apps. However, the story is not the same in my crypto investing. I've got a couple of wins like everybody else when everything was great. And then when it crashed down, I won because I got out early. But you know, a million people didn't do that and they bought back in and they're losing again. And today my money is back down again. And I just want to understand what the hell's going on? And I want to understand on an institutional level how this is being like built. What does the infrastructure for cryptocurrency and fintech in the future look like? But I think in order to understand that, this is just me being weird. I think you have to understand more the people behind it. I think one of the biggest reasons that we like normal Joes have a hard time investing in stuff we don't quite understand is that like the people, you know, your local investor person, you get them. You grew up with them. You went to school with them. That now they just call you and try to sell you some sort of wealth management thing. The crypto dudes are different. They're weird in a good way and a not good way. They're just different. It's very hard to relate to them. And I think that's the reason that for me, it's like, in order for me to understand this market and understand why people are doing what they're doing, I've got to understand the people who are building it. Because if I understand the people who are building it and like what makes them tick, maybe I can reverse engineer like how this whole thing is going to go. This is just a crazy crackpot theory I have. It's probably going to end up just like my Bitcoin today, which is crashing. Thanks, Donald Trump. Anyway, the conversation with Edward was amazing. Before we do that, we got to check in with the Startup Inbox, brought to you by ActiveCampaign. Go beyond email marketing with true automation by signing up at activecampaign.com/technori. Get your first 2 months for free. I use it. I read this in every one of these shows. If you're not clicking on this, you're an idiot. They're giving away a couple months free. And if you're a qualified startup, which I don't know what that means, but I think it means you're like you have promise, they'll give it to you for the whole year. So I don't, if you're not clicking, you're stupid. Okay. But people are reading this because we're getting these questions. So that's good. Rush to Market by Janet Brown. My competitors are close to launching their products faster than I am, than I have originally planned to. And my company launch is coming up here. Should I ramp up really quickly just to get out to market, or should I wait and make it, everything right? Honestly, you need to go to market as in you need to start talking about what you're bringing to market and start getting into circles where you're talking to people and presenting and talking on, talking on stage and in shows like mine and things like that. You need an MVP that might be, it depends on your business, but like might be heavy tech or it might just be simulated in a bunch of Excel sheets and brow sweat. You just need to be able to prove that there is a demand and that you know who has it, and you know who or how and how much it's going to cost to get it. The rest of this shit you can figure out on your own. As far as the market speed, I personally, and this might be why I'm where I'm at, either that means because I've done well or that means that I'm not doing as well as I should. I'm not really sure. But I'm where I'm at because I know my competitors, but I don't pay any attention to them. I literally don't care. They could launch a new podcast shit tomorrow. I don't care. I have mine and I can only make mine better. And I know my audience and I need to know them better. And I need to bring more of what I know they want to them. And if I can do that effectively, then we'll be good to go. I don't care. I'm not going to compete one-to-one because you're going to have 1,000 competitors if you're successful at anything and you're never going to be able to battle one-to-one. So you got to go one to market, like one-to-one. That's my advice. All right. Now we're going to have a conversation with Edward Woodford. He is the CEO and co-founder of Seed CX. I can't help but lead off a conversation with someone who knows exceptionally more than I do in the space of blockchain and crypto with my seemingly good strategy now turned bad strategy as it pertains to my investing in Bitcoin and other random coins like Ethereum. Mm-hmm. The market, I thought I had a read on it like everybody else. I don't know what I'm doing. And so... like other than you probably, I think you probably could like, you could look at a chart, I imagine, and have some sort of, or maybe not. Like, do you have, when you look at like Bitcoin or other charts, like do you see trends that make sense to you? And like you predict things kind of?
Yeah, I mean, we don't trade.
Well, obviously, but, I mean the company, just you personally.
I mean, I've learned about technical analysis and things like that, but I'm not a good trader, yeah. For a fact. So I think few people are.
I just can't, like, with markets, with, like, global markets, with stocks that I'm mm-hmm. familiar with, I can look at a trend and I can see media news and I have a general idea. Mm-hmm. I see acquisitions taking place that have nothing to do with the companies that are publicly traded. I have to say that.
Yep.
And I have a general idea of, like, when Salesforce is going to make their move on data. I bought Salesforce well ahead of time because it just seemed obvious to me. And yeah, it took a dip, but, like, I knew where it was going and it's rebounding. I can look at it. It makes sense. I look at a lot of the crypto stuff. And it, other than the fact that the stock market is down, crypto goes up, that's the only correlation that I've been able to capture. And so, like, I kept buying, I guess I call it hedging. I'll buy, you know, I bought Bitcoin at like 4,000 and change. I mm-hmm. wrote it up to like 11 or 12. I dumped out of it except for what I won, kept that in.
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah. And so I kept doing that. Well, now I'm in this spot where, like, it's going like 9 to 12, 9 to 12. Nine, and I'm like, what the hell? Mm-hmm. I can't take my money out in time. Mm-hmm. And I just, like, I lost all my winnings in the last, like, day, and I'm just depressed.
Yeah, well, it is super volatile. And, you know, things like Trump tweeting about anything. It. Yeah, but, you know, who knew that Trump was going to be tweeting about it yesterday? You had Mnuchin talking about it at kind of the head of the press conference. So, I mean, I think it's a good thing that, you know, there's more events starting to come up and people start to make, start to figure it out. But, I mean, what drives Bitcoin to Ethereum could, in theory, be very different things.
Right.
And I think you're going to start to see greater understanding of these different drivers and that the fact that Bitcoin is different to Ethereum and then, you know, Litecoin is different to Bitcoin for multiple reasons and people will start to figure it out. But you're right. I mean, a lot of this right now, a lot of the people who are making money in the space, having spoken to them, a lot of it is systematic. It's basically, they're just, it's a lot of it's algorithmic right now and that's how people are making their cash.
I'm telling you, like, I look at this and I'm holding on to my losses this time. I'm not selling. Just gonna ride it. I'll probably buy some more in.
Huddle.
Yeah, I'll hodl. Although you can't call someone a hodler when it's like a 3 month hold. That's like defeats. But in my mind, like, I looked at the Trump tweets and I was like, this is gonna be good, and then it didn't, like, the market didn't show that. And that's where I'm like, man, I feel like I have a pretty good understanding of what moves markets, but crypto has just totally befuddled me. And you actually just said something now that maybe shines a light on this somewhat. I think you know, you talked about the difference between Bitcoin and Ethereum and what moves one might not move the other and Litecoin mm-hmm. and other altcoins. Maybe there's just a level of sophistication that the, you know, safer institution and the idiot retail investors who are losing their money, the people who actually are trying to get in on this, they just don't have any sort of experience or sophistication around what the technologies behind those particular coins and assets are. Mm-hmm. Because, like, for me, If I didn't know anything about tech and like this sector and all the companies and people like yourself I talk to, I would be a very shitty investor in the market. I wouldn't know why one company is going up or down. But because I do have a lot of sophistication around business, it makes sense to me. I can see the leaps. Maybe the people are just, they don't see the leaps because they don't have any understanding of like what they're actually investing in.
Yeah, and obviously these things change as well, right? I mean, last year we had a couple of forks, which is basically the fundamental technology changes. So the asset, what Bitcoin is today as source code, potentially is very different in 10 years' time. So it's also a changeable
which I think
asset
that
as
really,
well, which is pretty interesting.
I think that's the part that's so cool, but it's also the part that I think fools a lot of people who are just sort of like tangentially involved. Like they're putting money on like it's a lotto. And they're not like actually investors.
Yeah, I mean, we don't touch retail, but having spoken to people who focus a lot on retail, there's obviously a whole spectrum. But you know, people who trade on Robinhood, they see something and they think it's pretty cool, and your flow gets sold to a proprietary trading firm that is basically paying for your flow.
Yeah.
So clearly, amongst the really sophisticated funds, people are making money off retail. Now, there's not necessarily anything wrong with that because retail potentially don't care about getting the absolute best price. But yeah, I mean, there is a clear distinction between different traders and we build things for institutions, but I have a lot of friends who are obviously very interested in the space, and that passion, even if people haven't made a ton of money about it, has definitely grown the ecosystem. I mean, the talent that's now flown into the space because people started initially trading has been great for the space, whether or not people have made a ton of money off of it.
I totally agree. I had a conversation with I don't think it was Jay, it was Michael, one of the co-founders of Top Step Trader here in Chicago. And again, this is just market stuff, but their platform sort of lets you pretend trade for a while. And I kind of likened the knowledge and the skill and the development of like becoming a real investor versus not even a retail, but like just a passive person, is you start to get to a point where you're knowledgeable enough that all of a sudden the percentiles matter. So like as a regular Joe on Robinhood, you're like, oh, I marked it to sell. I had a couple cocktails. I marked it to sell. The next morning it sold and like it was 950 or it was 951. I don't really know. In my mind, that lost me a dollar times the number of shares I bought. Inconsequential. To an institutional investor or fund, that's 9 trillion shares that was lost at like $1. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
And you start to get more sophisticated and like the more you know, the more you understand of this, the more you start to like really pay attention to like these little marginal pieces. And I think that's where, at least for me, again, this is projecting, and you would know way more than me on this, projecting into like the crypto sphere is like, once we get enough mass of people who start to have enough knowledge that they actually care about every little piece of move, I think that's like where we need to get. People just aren't quite there. They don't quite understand what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's, you know, as the industry matures, the type of people in the space will change. It will bring in the more traditional institutions that have potentially been on the sidelines. But yeah, I mean, it's gonna change. It's evolving. We're still pretty early. I mean, 2-3 years ago, very few people were talking about cryptocurrencies. Now you've got, you know, the Secretary of the Treasury and the President of the United States, every single bank governor, pretty much in the world now talking about digital assets, cryptocurrencies. So the pace of growth has definitely been pretty astronomical. But does that mean that all the other pieces and all the other pieces of the infrastructure have caught up? No. And it will get there.
I'm very excited about it. I think it's a very interesting space because it's just so new. And that's the cool part.
Yeah.
We're going to go forward and then we're going to go backward. I want to learn more about you as a person and sort of like what got you to this point. But for those who are listening, the Seed CX, what is it? And I want to learn a little bit about like how that was built and the purpose behind it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Seed CX is a institutional infrastructure provider for digital assets or cryptocurrencies. And so in short, we match buyers and sellers, and we also will settle those trades for people. So we'll actually move the fiat and we'll move the cryptocurrencies. So in short, matching buyers and sellers and then moving the assets so that they can actually hold them.
How long were you in the space before Seed CX was born?
Actually, I first got involved with cryptocurrencies when I was up during my grad studies and, you know, started to buy the assets, and I definitely wasn't a good trader because I got in very early and still managed to lose money. So I don't know quite how that happened, but you know, got in, did a project for actually a Bitcoin ATM, and became interested in the space and the fact that it was emerging, but actually went off and did something else and stayed in touch, looked at the space, and then about 2 years ago, actually, myself and my co-founder actually moved full hog into the digital asset space.
What is your co-founder's background? How did you meet them?
Yeah, so I met Brian whilst we were at MIT. We were doing a Master of Finance. And so there was very traditional finance, very traditional markets. And it was interesting. We were always interested in emerging markets, things that were kind of on the fringes, things that people didn't necessarily want to engage in. And that's what really drove us, is that we felt that we could capture edge, difference, whatever you want to call it, because we were willing to enter the space with the backgrounds that we had. And a lot of people are reticent to engage in areas that potentially people don't necessarily understand. People are very visceral beings. They hear something and then that's them. Well, they've made up their mind.
There's nothing worse, I feel like. And I mean, obviously there are, I'm very much generalizing, but there's very few things worse than like, whether it's family or friends, explaining what you're going to do and you can't explain it exactly. And they're like, what the hell? Like, this is not, this is like, what, this guy's throwing his life away. You went to MIT and you're playing around with this crap. Like you want to be able to tell people this is what it is and explain it. And if you can't explain it, which is edge technologies, it's like, am I crazy? Like, what am I doing?
Yeah, but I mean, now, but that's the same. But it's also works in the flip way as well, which can also play to the to the favor. I mean, you know, now everyone thinks crypto is revolutionary, and then you ask, okay, what, why? And often you don't get a very great answer.
You never get a good answer.
No, but
even from really smart people.
No, and but also, you know, we're talking about kind of the, you know, family and friends, but that actually permeates upwards to the CEOs of major banks, major corporations.
They go to work and they go to the water cooler and they start talking about it because that's the coolest thing that they heard about that no one else is talking about. So that makes them cool.
Yeah, I mean, but it also, you know, 2-3 years ago, when people like Jamie, or even more recently, Jamie Dimon was saying this is a everything's a con, and then you have Trump yesterday saying that's out of thin air. You know, these are perceptions that have been formed probably pretty quickly.
Yeah,
do you think they actually read the Bitcoin white paper? No. But these things can also
I hope Jamie Dimon has read the I know Trump has, and he doesn't read
it. No. Exactly. So it changes. It can play in both senses. A lot of people now, I mean, the perception has definitely changed and shifted. And there are still tough questions that have to be asked. There are things that still need to catch up from a technological perspective. But what has happened, there has definitely been a shift. I mean, banks are now engaged with the space. Regulators are more comfortable with the space. You have, you know, major companies like Facebook, whatever your view on that space is huge.
I'm forgetting the name of the company, but it was one I'm sure you'll know, had the first registered token offering.
Yeah, so that's on the security side.
Yep.
So yeah, I mean, things
legitimacy.
Are moving quickly.
You're starting to see like a need for legitimacy because real big players and banks that are managing General Joe's money are getting in it.
Yeah.
And you have to have something there. Like there, you can't just like put your money in this random, you know, Dogecoin. Like what?
Yeah, it the perception has definitely changed. And that shift. So skepticism is pretty contagious. But so is excitement, and so is kind of this potential. And so I think we're now in the other side, the flip side, where, you know, a lot of people are pretty excited by the space.
So I want to go back a minute here to you talked about before you got into this, you stepped away from the space for a minute and did something else. What did you do?
Yeah, so we founded a company that was focused on emerging markets. So similar. If crypto falls within the same bucket of assets, we were more focused on agricultural markets. And for whatever reason, that market wasn't developed and the major institutions weren't necessarily interested in these spaces. But we felt that we could capture some edge. And so we were doing this. We basically got regulated, got banked in essentially unbanked spaces. We developed products in industrial hemp, in avocados, limes, organics. It was a fine business, but it wasn't necessarily as exciting as we thought it could be. And so we then moved into the digital asset space about 2.5 years ago.
I asked you that because offline we were having this conversation about sort of picking that spot that like it's just unique and it's cool and exciting, and people step away from something like crypto where it's incredibly. I mean, I don't want to say like it's unscripted, but at this point, it's very much unscripted. There's so many things you can do. What Seed does today, you know, I mean, obviously you'll still be pretty well involved in market, but like it could be totally different. And you could have a totally different purpose, you know, even 5 years from now.
Things change very quickly. I mean, I think that's why when you kind of, you know, when you talk to early stage investors, what they're actually looking at, I mean, they look at the business plan, but they understand that the business plan is going to change, evolve, adapt, especially in a space like this, which is changing all the time.
Opportunity and the founder. Can you capture some of this opportunity?
Exactly. And I think that's what drives it. And, you know, it's figuring out what you find interesting and then how that manifests itself. I mean, ultimately what drives myself and Brian is we like the fact that this is an asset class where we can really go in deep, and I like the fact that we can change perceptions. I like the fact that some people think this is a bad idea. If everyone thought everything was a good idea, you know,
I'm a huge fan of bad ideas.
Yeah, well, I mean, sometimes you don't.
I don't mean literally bad ideas. I mean like the things that are just like. They're just out there, like big effing ideas. That's all it is.
Well, someone once told me about they called it the like idea matrix, and they said that the basically you could have it's either a good idea or a bad idea, and then people thought before that it was a good idea or a bad idea, and people just do not want to be in the column where everyone told you it was a bad idea and it turns out to be a bad idea. But the best place, the real innovation, occurs when where people said it was a bad idea but it turns out to be a brilliant idea. And trying to play somewhat as much as possible in that space, I think, is interesting, but you never know if it's going to be a good or a bad idea. You just have to sort of jump in and be motivated by something else and just it being a really, really good idea.
I have to go back in time with you to like the beginning, like parents and childhood and first jobs, because you like, there just aren't a lot of people who view things like that. Like, you are literally living on the edge. Like, that is your, like, if I had to write an MO for you right now, like, it would be edge. Like, I seek to find opportunities where there's an edge in anything, and it could be markets, or it could be agriculture, or crypto, whatever, but like, mm-hmm. you'd be in it if it had the edge. What, you know, what did you, where are you from, and what you have a general idea, you're not from Chicago.
No.
Where are you from, and, you know, what did your parents do? What was the experience like where you grew up?
Yeah, so I grew up a place called Southend-on-Sea, which probably isn't that well known. So it's a small, basically commuter town outside of London. Went to school there, grew up there, go back there as much as I can. Right on the seaside.
Nice.
So yeah, it's normally
it's
better
like this, except for, you know, the wet, like the actual heat right now.
Yeah, exactly. It's the weather tends to be a little bit better. But look, I mean, I was pretty lucky. I mean, I went to a good school, went to a good university, super fortunate to go to MIT. And you realize the thing I always say is, if you go to these great places, you don't question what you're doing, or what you want to do, yep. then you've done things the wrong way. And you know, sometimes there is pressure to go down the conventional path. But I was fortunate that my parents, for example, I called them up and I said, "Yeah, I want to go and raise money for this idea." And they didn't necessarily understand what it was, but they said, "Look, I mean, you haven't got any obligations, and try
yeah,
it."
Yeah.
And but you know, you have to be pretty. I think that's what people don't necessarily give credit for. They don't appreciate enough when to be a risk taker. You have to be pretty lucky, in the sense of, there is a safety net. There was a safety net for me. I knew that, look, I traveled around. I slept on 25 couches in 100 days, all of these kind of things. So, you know, you put yourself through quite a lot of pressure. But I knew that if things got really, really tough, I could jump. My parents would jump, get me a plane ticket yeah. and fly back to cozy England.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I was pretty lucky to have those kind of parents, pretty lucky to have those kind of experiences where you meet people, do interesting things, and to have those kind of... But I think there's always a safety net if you have a good education and you've done some things.
I feel like in listening to yourself and others, this is going to sound like a weird quote to reference, but I feel like entrepreneurs, and not even just entrepreneurs, it's like risk people who are willing to push the boundary.
Yeah.
One of the finite differences with the way that they consume their experience that is their life, I think it's fundamentally different from the average person who's like, do I have a car and a home? Like what they call bad, or like the bottoming out, is very different.
Yeah.
Like the quote I'll reference, Arnold Schwarzenegger, which is, like I said, doesn't seem like a quote. He talked about in his latest book or whatever it was, the fact that when he was doing the Mr. Olympia stuff, he had a chance to visit these like mines in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, these people are making literally a dollar a week.
Mm-hmm.
They're working 9 month stretches under the ground, thousands of feet below the ground. And they get to go home and see their family for a week. And then they get brought back into this, and their life expectancy is terrible.
Yeah.
To me, that is misery.
Mm-hmm.
That is the baseline.
Mm-hmm.
So anything above that is me doing good.
Mm-hmm.
And like when I heard it, it like hit me, because it kind of blew my mind. It's like, oh my God, like I'm not going to put myself in his sort of rarefied air. But I will say that like, I've always looked at it very similar to what you painted, which is to say, like, I'm fortunate enough that my parents could help me out if they need to. We're by no means wealthy, but we have the ability to be like, yeah, I can take a risk. I can go for it. The question is, am I okay living in a shithole for a while
yeah.
and not having money and balancing a couple of checks here and there and occasionally like having to, you know, scratch to get by? Am I okay? Yeah, I'm fine with that. That damage is worth whatever the outcome I'm hoping for is. And I think there's a whole lot of people out there that like, they just can't even fathom like that. Like the idea of that is so desperate.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not worth the risk to them. And that's just a different type of person. But when you say this, it reminds me, like, we had a conversation with David Colt here not long ago. And he was like, dude, like, I flew in a private jet to Malibu. And like, it wasn't that long ago that I was driving to California in the back of like this tiny little Subaru mm-hmm. and like just bumming a ride.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to be willing to like go for it.
Yeah, I mean, there's an asymmetry, I think, which people need to realize. The downside is probably only so bad. And the upside is
you're alive. How bad can it be?
Yeah, it's potentially great, but it's also that dichotomy as well, which you have to struggle with internally. Like you would have this perspective, like how bad can things really be? But also, you become really, really obsessive, and you make a ton of sacrifices to do this. So it's kind of you have this perspective. Okay, how bad can things really be? But if you just took that perspective, it's kind of a flip side, because otherwise you'd be like, well, nothing really matters. And then so why would I worry so much about
then
things?
Then it just then you like fall off a cliff and you become a monk or something, and it's just different.
Exactly. But so it's that kind of balance, I suppose.
I'm sure someone has talked about this, but I'd love to have a shrink come in on a show and talk. No, literally, like listen to this, because I look at this and I'm like, you talk about how you get so focused and you know you're pursuing this mission. I feel like that's just a defense mechanism that we all create, where we're just like, oh, as long as I'm focused on like what I'm doing, I'm not paying attention to all my friends who are the same age as me, graduate, now have kids and a family and a car and a house, and they work at UBS and it's wonderful, or so it looks. If you look at all of those outside things, well, then yeah, if you compare apples to oranges, then yeah, your life looks pretty miserable.
Yep.
But if you ignore all of that and you're like, yeah, I'm just not, yeah, I'm not living like the lap of luxury, but I'm eating, I'm happy, I'm an honest person for the most part, and I'm focused on my business, and I'm, you know, I'm making headways here and here and here, all of a sudden it looks completely different. Like that life, when you explain it that way, is like, who really cares where you went to sleep?
Yeah, no, I mean, to be precise, we did that for like, you know, the real early stages, and now we're in, you know.
Well, I didn't expect you to be bumming on couches today.
No, much stronger pace. But I mean, I think.
But that's the bottom, right? I mean, you raised $15 million. Yeah, like, let's say everything goes south. It went south.
You just go and get a normal job, which you probably would have got anyway,
right? Or you bum on the couch for a little while till you figure it out again. You don't even have to call your parents yet. You're not even desperate yet.
Yep.
Like desperate is like completely out of swings. I still have a couple. Yep. It's fascinating. So I want to figure, what is the first job you had? When was it? Whether before college, like what did you do for money the first time? How'd you make your first buck?
First time I worked in a warehouse packing. Basically wetsuits,
okay,
and water sport products. So it was really fun.
We've had a lot of weird jobs, and that's I mean, it's not a weird job. It could be packing anything, but it just happened to be wetsuits, which is different.
Yeah, but yeah, you get the intricacies of wetsuits actually pretty high.
Are you a boat guy? I feel like
I grew up by the seaside, everybody did something in the water.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a great job and great experience. You know, it was actually a founder-led company, and it's just great to see the business operations run and do something for yourself.
So that's a perfect segue here, because I'd love to know, like, you as a kid, and I try to create this thread of a conversation on all of our interviews where people can listen and learn. Quite literally, there's a theme of like, and this is just I'm projecting here. You mentioned that you're working for this guy. It's a founder-led company. So something about them being their own business owner struck a chord in your head.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about how you just learned some things. Watch, we're going to get into some of the things you learned. I think that the vast majority of people I know that are not in our world, I think they work at that job and they pay attention to paper cuts they got on their finger when they were loading up boxes, and they don't have the first damn clue who the guy is that runs it, nor do they care.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about you that you were like, no, this is an individual who was fortunate enough to build their own business, their own freedom, and they operated this business, and I learned from them X. What put you in that spot?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's confidence, right? It's people, you looking at people who have done things around you. It's having kind of what people call role models. I mean, when people, you know, I've gone back to MIT a couple of times and done talks, and I always say, look, you're probably not going to remember what I said most of the time, and you know, take everything I say with a pinch of salt. But if you get to know me, I'm a pretty normal guy. Most people would do really cool things. Yeah. Are pretty, you know, they're people like me and you, and they're normal. I mean, just have the confidence to try. I mean, the problem is most people never try, so they never take that risk, and it's having that confidence to just try. And if not, then don't worry. But it's that ability to try, and having somebody that you say, I mean, for example, at that space, at the warehouse, you know, figuring things out that could be done better. And you're like, well, actually, I can add value here. I can actually do things. I mean, this isn't, sometimes we put entrepreneurs on a big pedestal, but they're people. They have fallibilities. They're not perfect. And, you know, and neither am I. But having that confidence to say, well, okay, this is a normal person. I can also do this is quite a big thing.
This is probably completely off the rails at this point, but like, I had a conversation yesterday with a person who's taken two companies public and then exited a third company, all three completely different verticals, no relationship whatsoever, which is actually fairly rare. Most of the companies tend to have some sort of like stackability. And we had this conversation basically very much like this, where it was like, people look at entrepreneurs because they, in some cases, exceed ridiculous. In other cases, they flame out also ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
They don't realize, and we judge people against sort of this like success model.
Yep.
And I think a lot of times we forget to add that little asterisk that's to say not everybody wants to make the most of themselves. It's not that they're, you know, maybe they lack confidence, maybe a number of factors, but like sometimes people just literally want to just have a safe, they just want to be employed and like ideally being promoted along the same lines as everyone else that they're with. Don't really want to make a splash. Don't, you know, as long as I make enough money to like cover the ends, that's kind of it. And I think a lot of times it's really hard, especially with social media, it's really hard to see people who are doing exceptional things. And then amongst them is like all these other people are like, oh, they're so different. It's like a superhuman.
Mm-hmm.
And in reality, it's like they're the exact same as you. The difference is like what makes you happy is comfort and what makes them happy is discomfort.
Yeah. I mean, or being, yeah, I always say you have to be comfortable being uncomfortable. I mean,
yeah,
you
have to want to pursue that.
Yeah. Like, you have to be comfortable with that and willing to expose yourself to it. But, you know, I have friends who want to do different things and, you know, but it's to your point about what matters to you. Title doesn't necessarily matter to me so much. These other perks of some companies don't matter to me so much. I mean, I've had the same title when we were two people to when we're 45 plus people.
Yeah.
So it doesn't, being the CEO of a 2-person company doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah.
So sometimes you lose, but you know, at a bank, it's very, very kind of structured. Law firms are very, very structured. What matters to people is different. And sometimes when you've been in that environment, it's hard to necessarily step away, and it's not necessarily money, it's not necessarily it's comforts, but other things around a job that are comfortable.
Yeah.
Being perceived as, you know, in a big company to have lots of people work for you. I mean, it just really depends.
So you go to MIT, so you've gone through school, you've stacked a bunch of wetsuits and you're ready to go.
Yeah, more than I can count. Yeah.
In the middle of, did you start kind of getting the idea of like, it would appear to me that you had the idea of being somewhat of an entrepreneur pretty early on.
I mean, I don't know
if entrepreneur is the right word,
yeah,
but like you sailed the ship.
Yeah, trying to do your own thing to some degree. And I think some of the entrepreneurs that I've met are really amazing at bringing in people who have the same kind of instinct that I have. You don't necessarily need to found your own company. I mean,
yeah,
really good entrepreneurs will bring in basically the second level below them are, in a sense, entrepreneurs. That's what,
yeah,
we try to hire, people who I would go and work for.
Yeah.
That's really what we want to try and get. But yeah, I mean, it was just, we were fortunate, you know, huge amounts of, like, go back to this point. I mean, it's, some people just don't want to take the risk, but some,
yeah,
people just can't. And having the MIT brand, of course it helps. I mean, you get your foot into more meetings.
Yeah.
People give you a lot more credibility than at times you probably
sometimes
deserve.
Better valuation.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. And all these other pieces and all these signaling effects that we were fortunate to have.
It's like I had the same experience at Northwestern.
Yeah,
very similar, like sort of like got into doors that I shouldn't have gotten into. And honestly, in some cases it was actually a negative because there was assumptions made based on the degrees that I quote unquote had that like I must have mastered everything taught at the university. And it's like, no, I had a track just like everybody else.
Yeah.
And so then there's actually more sort of expectations there that like you don't want and you can't control. But I was in a position where I was like midway through grad school and I was like, I want to start my own business. I don't know yet what that's going to be, but I know like kind of the mechanics of how I'm able to make money. And the entrepreneur word, I like avoided it. I still kind of like cringe when I hear it actually.
Yeah.
I started getting called that afterward and like, I just own, like, I'm just like on a project, like in my mind.
Yeah, no, it's like coming on things like this. It's like, well, who do people actually want to listen to what you have to say? I mean, it's those kind of things.
There's a lot of things you're doing, though, if you're not aware of this. There's a lot of things you're working on that, like, there's like five different groups of people in this audience who are going to find this interesting,
mm-hmm,
whether it's crypto or other. So you leave, you're if I caught this right, Brian, the co-founder, went to MIT as well?
Yeah, so he did master everything. He got perfect GPA. I definitely didn't.
I'm not that guy.
Yeah.
No, I looked at like what's the minimum viable here. And I just like kind of provided that. So you guys kind of drum the idea up. You're kind of playing in crypto a little bit on your own for better or worse.
Mm-hmm.
You guys step out to do the ag market thing and you come back with this. What are some of the things that you've sort of learned? I mean, you're still pretty young. Like what are some of the things that you've learned and experienced as you start to build CX that like you feel are fundamentally like profound, what are the things that like you wouldn't be here without?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of it is people and kind of how you try to invest and build a team around you. It's investing in kind of culture. Sometimes is a fluffy word that big companies like to use, but culture means so much more than that. I mean, I think you have to be willing to lead from the front, right? I mean, if something goes wrong, you have to be willing to be there at 2 a.m. in the morning. You have to be willing to do that, and that's what establishes trust and driving that forward. And yeah, I mean, some of the lessons that you learn, you know, how to raise money, how to, you know, some of these other areas. But I think it's just the confidence to be able to learn things pretty quickly. And a lot of people think you need to be an absolute subject specialist. But really, if you can master lots of different areas, being able to come up with ideas is about understanding a lot about different things. And I think that's what people sometimes, they feel like they need to understand everything absolutely perfectly, rather than needing to understand a lot of different things and try and pull them together.
It's so funny. I'm just going to kind of expound on this a little bit. There's this conversation that we've had with, I don't even know at this point, hundreds of early founders. Mm-hmm. And I try to like this is why Technoria, when we used to have the showcase events, we used to have the big keynotes, and they would come in and tell sort of like talk about what they're doing. You would fall like right in the middle now. SeedCX is potentially could end up being one of those where you come back and talk to the world about what this looked like. Right now, you're way past that early, but you're still sort of feeling it out. And the thing that I've always tried to kind of convey, and I break the rule myself all mm-hmm. the time, which is not ideal, is that when you look at it from an org chart perspective, whether you want to call it people or just however you want to look at it, the mistake that I think a lot of young founders make, and the fortunate ones make the mistakes fast enough that they can and, mm-hmm. and don't make it again and can move on from it, but they try to build around a title or an idea of like who they're supposed to be and not around the strengths that they have and put their strengths where they're supposed to be and then build the team around the weaknesses and accept that, like, to the point you're kind of making, hiring the right people beneath you that you'd like to work for. You can't do everything.
No.
So like, you've got to be able to build this company, this team at this stage, it's a team. You need to build this team that's like being able to handle all of these major pieces where you can just sit back and kind of look at it and direct, like, listen, here's the mission. This is the roadmap of where we need to be. I not only can't I don't even know what's around this corner. So I need someone who can know what's around that corner.
Yeah. I mean, it's that kind of, I always refer to this kind of paradox of the fact that you need to be, obviously you need to instill confidence in the team. And, you know, when you're talking to clients and you're talking to investors, you've got to be, you know, very, very confident, but also you've got to make sure that when you come back inwards, you are very, very kind of brutal and kind of critical and thinking about and almost being kind of negative about what can be done better as a business, what can be done better as a team, what am I not so good at, what do I like doing, how can I supplement that. So it's kind of this two-faced approach, and sometimes people either become too negative and can't necessarily create a vision.
Well, they beat the shit out of things to the point where it's not, like, it's just not fixable.
Yeah.
For no reason.
Or you just become negative. But also equally, I think what we've seen is that you can become too positive and you're out telling the story all day, but you don't come back and you don't actually sit down and say, these are actually the things that are wrong
with
our business.
We've seen the extreme negative of what happens when one is too positive.
Yeah.
Like that, I think that, like, in a lot of cases, I mean, they're both bad because it doesn't work out, but like the negative thing, well, that's just a personal problem. Mm. The too positive thing, I think you end up becoming sort of like these leaders that are like carpetbaggers. They're not real people. They're just charlatan.
Yeah, and that's where I'm fortunate. I mean, you can never do everything as a as kind of one person, but that's why I'm fortunate to have a co-founder that we complement pretty well. But what's always interesting,
yeah, he's a perfect student, and you're not.
Like, it's, but I wasn't that bad. But
no,
what's
just, obviously,
but kidding. What's interesting is making sure that there's still enough of an overlap,
yep.
Even with the whole team. So, for example, I talk to a lot more customers than he does, but he's going away to London and Asia for the next week to make sure that he's still talking to customers and still gets that very direct feedback. He manages a lot more of the day-to-day technical pieces, making sure that when he's away, I'm more involved in those pieces, so that there's a degree of understanding of the different parts of the business, because that's what's so critical. I see every part of our business as necessary for success, and if one of those pieces breaks, whether it's compliance, tech, operations, finance, then that stops the whole pipe from flowing. And so it's kind of, I see a startup almost like a hose pipe. You can have the most beautiful hose pipe. It can be really long, really intricate. But if you have one tiny little kink, the water doesn't flow.
Yep.
And so being able to be aware of these different pieces, I think, think is really important.
Well, we've said this many times on the show. You can't manage what you can't see.
Yeah.
So, like, if you don't know what's going on the ground, doesn't really matter how high up you are, because you're going to be on the ground soon.
Yep.
I want to ask you one last question here, and it's mostly not, one, because I want to know from you, but two, because of the fact that I think blockchain and crypto in general, because there's just so much that can happen. Mm. For you, when you look at the position that you are in when you're trying to talk to someone to sell this, when you're trying to, what sales be, whatever it is, whether it's partnerships or direct, mm-hmm. whatever it is, how do you go into a conversation with a potential partner and actually sell them on the vision of what SeedCX is, or if maybe they have to be sold on the vision of the global crypto world?
Yeah.
How do you sell that? What is the tactic?
I mean, I think it's who you're talking to. So naturally, some people are more skeptical. Some people are more bullish in different parts of the different parts of the ecosystem. I mean, the reality of this market as it is today is that $200 billion is traded every single day.
Which is an insane number that I don't think people quite
know.
No,
but it's already a really big industry. Maybe not by very traditional asset classes, but it's still pretty big.
Yeah.
And the potential there is so much more. I don't need to be an acolyte on every single application of blockchain. I don't necessarily need to think that blockchain will succeed in every single area. I may even believe that it's going to fail in most areas. But what I'm bullish on is that it will transform certain key assets and industries. Yep. And that's what you're taking. Already a pretty big asset class, $200 billion traded every single day, plus right now, even more has been traded every single day. And imagine if this technology can be used for security tokens. You mentioned the security tokens before about certain parts of, even certain types of security. It doesn't necessarily need to be public equity. It could be certain parts of it. So I think that's what people misunderstand, is it doesn't need to be absolutely everything. It can still be pretty transformative. And so the vision that we talk about is, look, this is a really big market as it exists today, despite all the kinks that exist in the system, despite all of the problems that exist that we're trying to solve. If we can solve those, then the fundamental technology can really flourish. And that's where you get into really exciting concepts about broader tokenization, decentralization, and the benefits that blockchain can actually bring.
Would it be fair to say that you sell a vision?
I think to some people, yes. I mean, I think what we really sell today to the clients that are trading today is, you know, you're selling hard facts. You're selling them, you know, better technology, better compliance, better operational support. And sometimes it's the really small things that really matter to clients.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, obviously when you're talking to customers that aren't yet in the space, you're selling them a vision that they need to be somewhat involved.
But I mean, like, I look
involved.
At the people who are in it even, and it's like, at the end of the day, we're all sort of like drawing this conclusion. Some of them are different from others. Mm. It's like you're looking at this person. It's like, together with us, with these components, this is what the world could look like. This is what your world could look like. And in the end, like, I don't have to go nitty gritty on every single thing. We've got people on our team who could be better at telling you how to do this and this and this. But like, together, this is what this looks like.
To some people, you have to talk about the vision and how it can potentially change. But even if things don't change from today, it's still a pretty exciting big industry.
For sure.
I mean, you know, like we said, we have you know, everyone's talking about it.
Yeah.
Every industry, you know, every single prop shop in Chicago trades it to some degree. Pretty much, hedge funds are looking at it in a serious way. I mean, we have hedge funds with $10 billion plus under management as customers that are trading cryptocurrencies. I mean, it's pretty mind blowing when you actually look at it, what it is today, and that's just where it's come in a very, very short period of time. And so
it's like 2 years, and it's been like, we're at this point, which is nuts.
Yeah, I mean, the inflection point, the adoption cycle is definitely compressed, and that's what's so exciting by it. So you don't need all these pillars to fall for this space to be really, really exciting.
Yeah.
It already is, but imagine if one or two pillars do start to fall, then it becomes potentially this asset class or this technology can be used in everything. I mean, that's what's so exciting by it.
I believe you found your edge. I think you're all set. Edward, this has been a lot of fun. I appreciate you taking the time to come and share the story with us. Where do people go to learn about SeedCX and to get involved with you guys?
Yeah, so you can go to www.seedcx.com. We're also on Twitter, LinkedIn. And yeah, looking forward to hearing from some
awesome.
People. Cheers.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You can learn more about upcoming investment opportunities. Check out the blog at technori.com. Subscribe to the newsletter. Download the podcast on Spotify or Apple. Follow us on social at technori. You can follow me at Katoon. Boom, that's a wrap.